Good morning, I'm Michael Cathcart, and you're so very welcome to Books and Arts. On the show today, a performance which celebrates some last meals and some memorable dying words.
A lot of them were invented. People want the last words of famous people to be meaningful, and I think some of them are.
And from WA, we meet a Noongar artist who discovered a love of art in the most terrible of circumstances.
The only good thing in that place, in that horrible, disgusting, cruel place, was this amazing picture of an angel. And this angel was just the most beautiful, beautiful image.
And you'll meet the artist who's elevated the introspective doodle to an epic art form. It's good to be with you this morning on RN, on your ABC Radio app, online or on your radio.
This summer I went swimming, this summer I might have drowned, but I held my breath and I kicked my feet and I moved my arms around, moved my arms around. This summer I swam in the ocean and swam in a swimming pool. Salt my wounds, chlorine my eyes. I'm a self-destructive fool. Self-destructive fool.
The swimming song performed by the McGarrigal Sisters, a nice song, a song from my very happy past, actually. And I've used it here to introduce a seriously good thriller. It's called The Lost Swimmer, and it's by Melbourne writer Ann Turner. It's the nail-biting story of an archaeology professor named Rebecca Wilding, who was a nice, kind, conscientious woman. I'm sure that in real life she'd been a books and arts podcaster. She's one of us. She's probably got the ABC radio app on her phone. She's also a mum with a couple of kids and a rather hunky husband. But her entire life has become a nightmare because at the university she's facing serious charges of embezzlement. And it's not her fault. Well, I don't think it is her fault. It really looks as though someone close to her set her up to go to prison. And she suspects that her hunky husband is not all that he seems. Anyway, I read this at the weekend and I enjoyed it immensely. Anne Turner is an award-winning filmmaker. This is her first novel and she's sitting right in front of us. Howdy doody.
Hello, Michael. Nice. Thanks so much for having me.
To have you here. So Rebecca Wilding is Professor of Archaeology at Coastal University, which looks a bit like Deakin, I suppose, and she's the head of the School of Classics and History, which is a pretty thankless task. What's the state of play at the university when we meet her?
Well, the university, like so many, is going through a time of great change and having a lot of cuts, and it's really hard for both academics and other staff as people are getting retrenched.
It's toxic.
It is, absolutely.
It is a toxic campus. And this isn't Deakin, we should say. It's based on many universities, and we could think of one in particular, perhaps. So things are not good. And poor old this poor old professor, who's such a nice woman, is really just trying to look after her department and keep it together.
She is. She really cares about her staff. She's been there for many, many years, rising up the ranks, really from senior lecturer to associate professor to professor, and now head of department. And she's really struggling in that role because she cares so much about people and she doesn't like to see people mistreated.
No. But the dean is toxic as well.
The dean is a bully, basically. And I think there's a lot of that goes on in universities. Mm. I mean, universities are such small little worlds, I think, and they have good people and bad people, and they do have a lot of bullying that goes on.
Yeah, so Priscilla is the dean.
She is indeed.
She's a very nasty piece of work indeed. I enjoyed Priscilla in a sort of sicko way. Now, I guess implicit in the way you've told the story is a critique of the changes that are sweeping through universities, which are being defunded and the students are being transformed into clients. I mean, what do you say is going on?
They are. I think that universities really are at a crossroad where they have been about education, but now they're becoming businesses and they're sort of having to become businesses. And in that, I guess you get people who really aren't necessarily skilled business people because they're educators. So it's a very strange, volatile mix. And I think there's a lot of mishandling of the way cuts are brought in. And I think there are sweeping changes that come through. Certainly I've seen it. I worked at the Victorian College of the Arts a number of years ago. And, you know, you see one government comes in with one set of policies and then another government comes in with another. And so universities are really struggling between being government funded and also needing to find their own funds.
Well, it also changes the culture among students, because when students say, well, I'm paying top dollar, and they're being told the only reason you go to university is to enhance your prospects as an earning person, you know, as a wage earner, as a maker of money, there's no ethos particularly of public service anymore. Because if students say, well, look, I'm paying for all this, it's costing me top dollar. The idea that I'm going to work as a voluntary doctor in the third world or, you know, run a local legal service or something, I mean, why would I do that? I've got to pay back this debt.
Yes, I think that's certainly changed education over the years. And I think that's twofold as well. I think students are having to earn more money to themselves to pay for university. And so that changes the education of them as well, because they're not as available. And I know that a lot of universities are finding that students don't turn up to lectures anymore.
Well,
and some universities are actually not having lectures. Well, is Adelaide University changing that,
I'm not sure. But, I mean, you also find as a lecturer that the students aren't coming onto campus because you're actually uploading your lectures anyway to a website where they can listen at a time of their choosing, which
That's
I suppose
right.
is okay, but it's very impoverishing for online life because on-campus life. Because the old campus in which you had all this kind of tumult and fury and socialising and theatre clubs and footy teams and political organisations, all that's withering as people become much more focused on university as a way of getting a qualification. Anyway,
that's
look,
right.
That's a kind of critique that's running through your book, but we shouldn't give the impression that that's overwhelming it. In fact, it's driving the drama a bit, because here you've got your head of department who is managing all these accounts. In fact, you've done something pretty amazing. You've made accounting really kind of scary.
I think it can be.
Yeah. So here she is in goodwill trying to run all these accounts, and an anomaly appears, and then it gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and suddenly she realises quite late in the day that there is a multi-million dollar hole in the accounts, and it looks as though she's the one who's nicking all the dough.
That's right. Someone's setting her up and she doesn't know who. And as an archaeologist, she's used to digs and digging up artefacts. But she's not really that skilled in finance, in running a department.
No, she's an archaeologist.
She's an archaeologist. And I think that's another university thing, that heads of department come up through their skill set.
Mm.
And so as an archaeologist, she knows how to deal with people. She's worked on digs. She's really good with people. But she has been signing things, feeling very angelic, signing off on things without realising the implications that somewhere has she signed off on the wrong thing. But then maybe she hasn't. Has someone forged her signatures? And that's what she's trying to discover through the book, because she thinks she's innocent. But I think for a reader, as we go on, we're not sure if Rebecca is an unreliable narrator or not.
No. We don't quite know whether she's an unreliable narrator. She could be nicking the stuff herself. I don't believe she is. I'm on her side. But I can see that you could read this book as though this woman has constructed this entire account of what's gone wrong with her finances to cover her own tracks. I don't reckon she's done that, though. On RN, this is Books and Arts. You might be listening on the ABC radio app, as I'm sure our hero would be, Rebecca Wilding, Professor of Archaeology, who is the hero, or is she the villain, of The Lost Swimmer. And the author of The Lost Swimmer is sitting right in front of me. She's Anne Turner. And, yes, it's a book I've enjoyed immensely. So she's got a husband, quite a hunky husband, called Stephen, who's a fellow professor. He's a professor of economics. And I think we know right from the start that he's going to get lost, because it's called The Lost Swimmer and he's been into swimming. And you play on that expectation rather cleverly, because every time he walks out of the room, I think, oh, will he come back? Is this the last she's ever going to see of him? All the way through, I was thinking that. Is this it? So you've done that quite well. It's a page turner. How did you decide what the key elements of a thriller were? You must have thought through this. How did you think about constructing this story so it would have us on the edge of our seat in the way it does?
Yes, that's a really interesting question, Michael, because it really started off when I was on the Amalfi Coast, and I thought I'd booked a hotel in Amalfi, but in fact it was out of Amalfi, and the only way in or out was this hideous winding road hanging off the edge of a cliff and with a tiny little wall and then this huge death drop to the sea. And so essentially, we were in this hotel stranded, and the only way in or out was by bus because we weren't driving, and all the buses were dented right down their side. And when we got to the hotel, I thought there was a private beach there, and they gave me the key and they said, "You Australians are good swimmers, aren't you?" Which I thought sounded fairly foreboding. And when we got down to the private beach, it was this rocky ledge with waves slamming in sort of metres high. And I thought, what a terrifying place. And it would be awful to lose someone in this dreadful area where you're so stranded. So that sort of became the core, the starting point of the thriller for me. And then I wound everything around that and I saw so many friends going through the time at university of losing their jobs, being retrenched or battling to keep others from being retrenched. And I thought, well, it'd be nice to sort of have academia as a setting for the thriller. And I wound those two things together and then I plotted it out because coming from film, we write treatments. And so I actually did sort of write the plot points out rather than, I know a lot of authors really just write as they go. So I suppose I came from a slightly different area as a writer and plotted it quite carefully as a thriller.
Yes, it's quite interesting comparing the way films are written from the way books are written, because films, because they cost a lot of money, you have to actually pretty much work out what the film is before you get the dough, don't you?
And, absolutely.
And there's actually a way, there's a standard format in which you explain what the film is in basically two sentences, and then you explain what it is in a paragraph, and then you explain what it is in a page, and then you explain what it is in five pages. So you've got various ways of telling the story. So you know your story both as a kind of thing you could write on the back of a calling card, right through to something that you can pitch for 15 minutes before you've even actually shot a single frame.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so I did approach writing a novel from that aspect. So I did... I was always going to write a treatment, but I never did. It did take off. The characters took off for me, but I did do the sort of one-liners and the plot points.
Yeah. Well, it's got great scenery, this book of yours. I mean, it would make a great movie because we go to Paris and Athens and it cost a fortune to make,
yes. Of course.
Crete and Venice, the Amalfi Coast, as you say. And the terror rides in the car, there are a couple of terror rides actually on this coast, had my heart in my mouth. I've been on those roads, and buses particularly, where you feel as though the bus is just going to sway and topple over the edge. Totally terrifying. It could work as a movie, don't you reckon?
Oh, it certainly could. But one of the interesting things is that I felt absolute freedom as I was writing it, not having to worry about budgets. Because, of course, when you write for film, everything comes down to how much is it going to cost? Can you go to all those locations?
Yeah.
You know, as an Australian filmmaker, it's going to be chopped back. You're going to start with four locations and end with one.
And do we really have to have them on a bus? Couldn't we have them on a bicycle?
That's right.
We could probably borrow a bicycle, whereas we'll have to hire a bus and there'll have to be extras in the bus. So suddenly the person you thought was on a tour of 20 people is hitchhiking down a lonely road.
That's exactly right, Michael.
That's the way movies get made. Yeah. Now, this is one of those books. Have I said I loved it? I loved it. This is one of those books which ends with a couple of pages of discussion points for reading groups. I don't know whether you even know this is there. Did you know this was in the back of your book?
I did. Simon and Schuster are absolutely fantastic. So they've kept me involved and informed at every step.
Right.
They've been wonderful. So, yes, I got to look at the notes and give comments. But actually, I thought those notes were fantastic. I've virtually had nothing to say.
Okay, good. I don't know who uses them. I suppose some reading group might use them. But I particularly like question 9. So I'm going to ask you question 9. Reading groups, take notice. This is question 9 in the questions for reading groups. What is the significance of the scene when Rebecca's dog, Big Boy, which is a strange name for a dog, lunges at a Joey, which is feeding on the family's back lawn with its mother? So the kangaroo has been tagged by university researchers, is called Bonnie. And you've got this incredible scene where she's walking with her dog. They see this kangaroo that they've got to know. It's got a Joey. And suddenly the dog, Big Boy, lunges at this Joey and gives it a good shake. And really, there's a lot of injury results. The scene does feel laden with symbolism for reading groups. Anne, what is the significance of that scene?
Well, I think it's a very important scene in the book because it really shows that Rebecca's world is tipping out of kilter, that things aren't right, that something's wrong with the balance of her life. And so the dog that she trusts implicitly suddenly attacks this Joey, absolutely out of the blue. And it's a vicious attack. And in that vicious attack, Big Boy the dog actually bites Rebecca as well.
And she turns on
turns,
his own master,
yes,
or mistress.
Literally, you know, bites the hand that feeds him.
Yeah.
And so Rebecca just, it's the whole thing about trust and that these kangaroos have been so trusting of the environment, that she trusts the dog so much, her dog, and everything just is thrown out of kilter. And I think that's the start of her life really starting to tip for the worse after that scene.
Yes. I suppose that's right, when she realises that betrayal is all around her. And she starts to suspect that her husband, the hunky husband, may not be all he claims to be, all she's believed him to be.
Exactly. And she's not sure. She's really hoping that she's imagining things, but they've been married for 25 years and she really has a sense that he's having an affair. And that's just awful for her, because she's been with him from a very young age and he is her life. He and the children are her life with her work.
Yes. Also, her books are in disorder. Her accounts are in disorder. She can't tell why. And he's an accountant. He's an economics professor. So he'd be in a good position to have done the deed.
But she feels so humiliated as a head that she hasn't picked it up, and she wants to try and sort it out. And I think that shows in the relationship there is a slight lack of trust. There's a wanting to seem in control of your life and not let your husband see that you've messed up, basically. So she's really hoping she can sort it out. And she's been on the other side of investigations as a senior professor. She and it was something I was very interested in, actually, in the research, how universities, when there are allegations against people, the first investigation is internal. So they actually get senior professors to investigate other staff. And then if there's a criminal element involved, and that's been proven, that's when it's turned over to higher authorities, and that's what happens in The Lost Swimmer. So Rebecca knows from being an investigator that the university will have a process and people will not be told. It'll be very confidential. So she actually hopes that she can solve what's going on with the fraud and no one, including her husband, ever needs to know.
Well, and you're really good at this. I can't believe this is the first one you've ever done, because it's absolutely fantastic. I gather, as we wind up, there is another one in the pipeline?
There is. It's called Out of the Ice, and it's set in Antarctica, and actually an island. The first part is set in Antarctic Australian Territory, and then it moves to an island off the Antarctic Peninsula called South Safety Island. And the central character there is an environmental scientist who finds certain things are really amiss.
All right, well, that's to come. But for the moment, The Lost Swimmer, it's by Simon & Schuster. Well, it's published by Simon & Schuster. It's by Anne Turner. And thanks for being my guest.
Thank you so much, Michael, for having me.
And as I say, I read it last weekend. And if you like thrillers, this one's a goodie. On RN, this is Books and Arts. You're on your ABC radio app. Perhaps you're listening online. Perhaps you're listening on the wireless. I'm Michael Cathcart. Our next guest here on Books and Arts is Greg Creek, who has an exhibition at the Shepparton Art Museum, which is in rural Victoria. And his work is made up entirely of years and years of desktop drawings. There are thousands of sketches, notes, even the odd food stain. Fiona Gruber has seen it. She joins you and me in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to have you here. I gather that you've been in touch with this work for some time.
Yes. Back in 2003, I went to the Australian Centre for Contemporary Art in Melbourne and saw the original viewing of this, Greg's Melbourne desktop drawing. It was over 30 metres long and I absolutely loved it. So, yeah, Greg, tell us how you started doing these drawings.
Well, good morning, Michael and Fiona.
It's nice to have you here, Greg.
Thanks very much. Look, I began doing them in the studio, like lots of artists do. They draw in the studio. They might be painting as well. And I used to make doodles on the desk that I was working on, and like lots of people used to throw those out. But then a friend of mine said one day, they're drawings, they're artworks.
But you mean you had two kinds of drawing on the go at once? You had the drawings over here, which were your real art, and you had your doodles over
I did. I had drawings and sketchbooks and things like that, and I had the mess on the desktop that I was working at, which had the coffee stains as well, and that's what used to get thrown in the bin. But then my friend said, no, you should keep those. And from that sort of insight...
I reckon I'd be insulted, Fiona. I mean, if someone said to me...
Oh, no, I know
you think these are this is your artwork over here, but I quite like your doodles.
Yes, but it was the potential of what the other ones offered up.
So when you stop scribbling and you have that self-consciousness, now I'm making an artwork. How did that change the way you were doing things?
Well, of course it changes things because, you know, it's not an unconscious stream anymore. But artists do that all the time. They play strategies with how they work and they take different approaches to making. So it became a bit more precious at times, but then it allowed you to be a bit more sort of dangerous with those drawings as well. Take risks.
So let's look at what you've got on at Shepparton Art Museum, because there are five different elements to this exhibition,
aren't
there?
Indeed. Look, the reason I'm here is because Shepparton brought the work into their collection, which is a fabulous thing, and the curator at Shepparton, Kirsten Paisley, and I decided rather than just plonk the work into the local community and say, here, look at this, we'd build a show around it. So we looked at the history of the drawings, some of the processes that had preceded the Melbourne drawing, and a few works, including a new one, which have come after it. So it gives a really broad sort of view of this practice and some of the possibilities that come out of it.
So there are the drawings you've done around Melbourne in the last, 15-odd years or so.
Yep.
Then there are ones that you did in Edinburgh as well, aren't there?
That's right. The show includes a work called Chatter Shapes, which was commissioned for the Edinburgh Festival by Jonathan Mills. And it is a similar drawing to the Melbourne one, but it approached the city of Edinburgh in Scotland, where I was fortunate enough to spend some time and did drawings and things and then assembled similarly a big, large drawing work.
Now, when I saw it originally, I was looking at all these little doodles and drawings, and then suddenly I came across some words you'd written, and you said, X, and we won't name her, but she's a very attractive designer. And X came into the studio today. She's split up with Y, and she's looking really beautiful. And I went, ooh. So you write quite personal things on that, and I believe that someone else saw that too.
Well, they did. Look, you know, when you open up a working space, and let's think about it that way, a thinking space, then everything that occurs in your day can be included in that space. It's not a selective space that a painting may be. And this friend, who was a good friend, and she had just recently broken up with a partner, so it was tragic, but she looked like she was coping. But I found out later that some of her students had subsequently come into the show at ACCA. They'd photographed that section of the drawing and reproduced it into a card and given it back to her.
That's really nice. I think that's really
cool. I'm not sure. I think you need to take a page out of the novel writer's book, Greg, and think that, you know, when you're basing a work of art on a real person, you give them a fictional name and you change their gender and give, you know, turn blondes into brunettes and whatnot.
I think she would have liked it.
I think I've spoken to her since at the time, and she certainly wasn't offended by it. She was touched.
Yeah.
She was touched by the fact that the student had...
Fiona, when did you first see Greg's work?
In 2003. And, you know, we're talking about a 30-metre-long table. And what's amazing about it is that you're looking at it from the same distance as the artist, as Greg, is writing and drawing on it. So you've got that sense that you're in it with him.
You know, I don't quite understand how you make them. Are these doodles you've all joined together, or do you create this endless thing from the word go?
There's two different ways. In one way, I start with a big long roll of paper. So, you know, there's associations with Chinese scroll paintings and so on and so on, and you roll a piece out as you work on it each week. But in this drawings, and many of these drawings, I then cut the drawing back into itself. So a bit of the drawing that may have been drawn way at the end ends up being cut into way at the front. So there's a sort of cinematic montage effect as well. And in my mind, it sort of echoes how we experience the everyday.
There are lots of little architectural drawings, because you trained as an architect, didn't you, Greg?
I studied as an architect and then left, dropped out, as many of them do, after 1 year at uni.
So do you like, when you're coming and you're doodling, because this has almost become your practice now, hasn't it? You used to do big allegorical paintings, and now you're like a full-time doodler.
It's true. It's sort of the doodle elevated to the level of high art. Look, it suits my temperament to work that way, and it means that it's not as project-driven, and you're not always trying to select what should go into the preferred nature of the work, but you're letting things organically appear in the work. There's still structure, but it's a sort of a more holistic approach to making the drawing. So, and it's a very broad language. Because, as you're suggesting, there are architectural drawings and watercolour renderings of portraits and texts and spills and cuts. So there's a big range of stuff, and it sort of allows you to compose and balance all those elements.
Yeah, I was looking at one, and there's a watercolour of a horse that stops at the neck. Then there's a sort of pen and ink, or just a sort of biro picture of a woman's head. And then the Tower of Ormond College, Melbourne University, shooting out the top of it. And it's like, did you do that at three separate stages and just thought, oh, look, I'll just add a woman's head to the horse or a horse to the woman's head?
Well, it was a bit of both. I mean, it was a memory, really. It was a memory from many years before. It was a memory from 15 years before of a girl who I'd known at Ormond College, you know, as a friend. But there'd been certain events in her life, and so I was reflecting on those events, and this little sort of cluster of images came up about that person.
Because you're also, as well as these things from the past, you're also making work that kind of refers to now and the future, aren't you? Because you're doing these pictures in Shepparton, you're going up and doodling
That's
there
right.
while the show's going
so
on.
So while the show's on, I'm producing a body of drawings, frame drawings of the people in Shepparton. And so rather than, again, just going up and saying, here's the finished work, I'm adding pieces during the 10 weeks or 3 months that the show's on. So I'm about 15 drawings in of what will maybe 40 drawings, and I still don't know what the other ones will be. So I'm going up to Shepparton during the week, and I'll take some drawings up, have a think, and we'll see what comes up.
On RN, this is Books and Arts, and in the studio is Greg Creek, and he's talking with me and with you and with Fiona Gruber. Doodles is a funny word to use. I mean, the more you talk, the more I think doodles in some way plays down the scale and ambition of the works.
Look, I think you're right. We're using shorthand, aren't we? We're sort of trying to give a sense of not only what the content of these little drawings may be, and sometimes they're large drawings, but sort of the notion of their at-handedness. The character of how they're brought into the world. And so they're not studies or drawings of studies, which drawings traditionally have been for larger works. They are things within their own right. And so they have the character of being finished at times and highly wrought, but also of being conjectural and sort of, casual.
Conjectural?
Well, they put ideas forward. They suggest ideas rather than try to talk to what answers may be. So they pose questions about what they might be, a bit like Fiona was saying about the girl with the horse and so on. But they pose questions to the other elements of the drawings around them.
And does that suggest, Greg, that you're a person who looks at the world and is not quite sure what the answers are? You're not a person driven by ideologies?
I'm interested in ideologies. I'm interested in ideologies, how they play out with us.
But some of us have great political certainty. Some artists know what
the... No, I don't have great political certainty.
But you have some political... You write, you know, you've scribbled some
Indeed,
political
I
ideas.
Do.
And there's a kind of sense of palimpsest, isn't there, about it? There's layers of ideas that come through over the years.
Well, one of the things that I think about is that, you know, if you think of deeper time, we've sort of lost the certainty of certain ideologies or narratives, master narratives, that existed in either mythological stories or theological stories from the Bible or what have you. And what we seem to be left with is celebrity and sports people and the everyday. And those sorts of characters, those sorts of figures sort of replace the sense of universal stories we have. And so I think I pick up some of that.
We started this conversation as though what you were doing was kind of zany, but I'm starting to understand that actually it's quite ruminative and reflective.
That's true. That's right.
So is there a... I mean, because when you look at drawings from the past 500 years ago, when you look at the drawings that are in preparation for a painting, they're so much fresher in a way than that finished painting. Do you feel the same way about your work, that there's a kind of such an intimacy about how you're doing it and what you're saying?
What I originally felt was this, and that was that in putting a lot of work into a painting, you select things that go into the painting, but there's an awful lot that gets missed out. And I realised that you could work with that. You could work with the other things that hadn't been put into work, so sort of like the discarded. And what it does is tell the same narrative, but in a different form.
Because I was thinking, looking at them and looking at that whole layering, that, you know, if in 100 years there's a Greg Creek retrospective, and I'm sure there will be, you know, what will people... We don't know what it's going to be like in 100 years, but what will they think of when they look at your work? What idea of the times we live in will they get from your work?
I think they'll think those people thought about a lot of things, that their interior world was very dense and packed out, and it matched the external world as well. And I think they'll think, which is what I do now, that the two are intertwined and that we are constructed from that interior sense of self as well as the external. You know, as Michael said, ideologies, perhaps.
So it's a sort of fantastic journey in the mind of Greg Creek, and also in the times of Melbourne, Victoria, Edinburgh, the world.
And Shepparton as well.
And Shepparton as well. Fantastic.
Yeah, I love that sense of scale from the global to the very intimate. Greg, thanks for coming in. It's been lovely to meet you.
Thank you.
My pleasure, Michael. Thanks, Fiona.
Greg's been talking to us here. Fiona Gruber's been with me in the studio. The show is called Greg Creek, the Desktop Drawings. Where is it, Fiona?
It's at the Shepparton Art Museum, and it's on until the 9th of August.
That's the Shepparton Art Museum until the 9th of August. On RN, this is Books and Arts, and still to come, Last Meals and Dying Words. That's Noongar singer Gina Williams with Guy House. Well, you and I are heading now to Noongar country in the southwest of Western Australia and the home of artist Sandra Hill. Sandra was taken from her parents at just 7 years of age, the third generation of her family to be removed and placed in an institution. And she found some healing in art. She's now a prolific painter, sculptor and public artist. Her Homemaker series of paintings puts Aboriginal women, often in traditional dress, in the centre of brightly coloured domestic scenes from the 1950s and 60s. Sandra Hill is a finalist in this year's Western Australian Indigenous Art Awards. Claire Nichols meets the artist at her Bullingup studio.
My name's Sandra Hill and I'm a visual artist living in Bullingup. We're in my art studio, which is rather messy at the moment, but I've been too busy to reorganise it and get it ready for the next project. These four artists are involved in this. All those boards for the Leech Highway noise walls are sitting outside, wrapped up for me to do, and the St John of God's is just.
I love this picture that you've got in the corner here. Can you tell me a little bit about that one?
This series of work is, I call them the grey people, but they're the Homemaker series, and I've done quite a number of them, one of which is going to be in the Indigenous Art Awards. But what it is, it was a program in the 50s, 60s, where Aboriginal people were finally given, or not given, but they were allowed to live in a regular house and taken off the fringe camps. Of course, you had to apply for that. And during this, there was a Homemaker series, or a Homemaker program, where white women would go in for about 3 months and try and teach the Aboriginal families how to live like a white person. So really it was another way of getting you to leave your Aboriginality behind, your culture behind. And it was the absurdity of it is that they expected that we would learn how to be white within a three-month period and knock out 50,000 years of cultural learning and cultural heritage. So the painting is all the white people in it are in tones of black, white, grey, hence the grey people, because we were categorised by the colour of our skin, by the government, by shades, by quarter caste, full blood, quarter caste, half caste, quadroon, and white. So I've reversed it onto the white people and made them all grey.
Is there a little bit of humour involved in this sort of art?
There's a little bit of spite.
You've said before that art can be a great tool in the healing process. How has art helped you to heal, do you think?
Well, it's really, without it, I don't know where I would have been, seriously, because being taken away, it's such a difficult thing to navigate, you know. Coming to grips with it, not just coming to grips with it, but, you know, finding your family and not knowing who you are, and I guess knowing that you're other, there are other people just like that that are struggling and suffering and trying to find their way, I guess. And art just, it was my refuge. It was really my refuge from when I was little. when I was in the orphanage, and this is how I started to paint. When I was in Sister Kate's children's home for half-caste kids, they made us go to church every day, and we marched into church, and the only good thing in that place, in that horrible, disgusting, cruel place, was this amazing picture of an angel. And this angel was just the most beautiful, beautiful image. And it was the only beautiful thing in my life at that time, other than my brothers and sisters, but we weren't allowed to see them. So, and that was the difficulty, was I had to focus on something to make, to help me survive that traumatic experience, that emotionally traumatic experience of losing your mum and your dad and your brothers and sisters and everything that goes along with that. So I just focused on this angel, and I knew this angel like the back of my hand. I mean, she was, I still remember it. It's fixated in my brain, really. And it was my tool for survival. When I was fostered out by a white family, when I was about 9, nearly 10, they gave me papers and pencils and paints and crayons, and which we never had, anything like that in the orphanage, and I began to try to reproduce the angel, and I started drawing, and I would draw, continuously draw this beautiful face of this angel, you know, and I taught myself. It's all I did. I didn't learn. It was just a mission that I was on to reproduce this angel, to bring back that beauty, because it wasn't all fun and games at the foster, with the foster family either, you know. So it was an escape, and it still became my escape even at the foster home. And from that point, I just kept drawing. And when I was at school, I can't cope with sport. I hate sport. Or when all the kids were playing and doing, you know, playing ball and things, I'd be on the veranda drawing at primary school. And I was very fortunate because I had a wonderful, wonderful teacher who saw that I was gifted somehow in that area. And he allowed me to do all the designs for Christmas on the blackboards, and Easter, and in the holidays, I could draw all beautiful images on the blackboards, and he'd buy me new sets of crayons. It was wonderful. And he said, you could be an artist when you grow up. And I just hung on to that. And I wasn't encouraged very much by my foster family, but I just thought, one day I'm going to be an artist.
This horrible experience that happened to you as a child, how do you think that's shaped the art that you make? Is that a theme that comes back in everything you do?
Oh, I'm obsessed. It's very much so. I cannot just paint a nice, pleasant picture. There has to be a theme. There has to be a story. There has to be information for the wider community. It's almost like it literally is kind of an obsession. And I feel that's important, because there are few who can talk about their experiences, the same experiences I had, my brothers and sisters had. So I feel like I've got to kind of, well, not got to, I choose to tell the stories, because it's therapeutic for me to paint them and to create them. But it's also therapeutic for others to see that somebody else is talking about it and showing white people that this is our experience. This is what happened to us. This hurt us. It hasn't gone away. We're still feeling it. We're still experiencing trauma from those days. It's all cause and effect. And as long as I'm breathing, I think I'll just always be telling those stories. If it's not women's things, which is what I'm focused on for the last probably maybe 6 years, it'll be about our culture, celebrating culture and celebrating at the survival and renaissance of our culture.
Gosh, that's a powerful story, isn't it? Noongar artist Sandra Hill there speaking to our Perth producer Claire Nichols. And Sandra is a finalist in the Indigenous Art Awards, and it's a $50,000 prize, the Western Australian Indigenous Art Awards, and the winner of that will be announced on Friday. You're on Books and Arts on RN. We're online, we're on air, and we're on your ABC radio app.
Still alive, but the air is getting bad. Oh, how I love you, Mary. I have made my peace with God. Oh, how I love you, Mary.
The American folk singer Joan Baez with a track called Henry Russell's Last Words. The lyrics come from the dying words of a miner who was fatally injured in a coal mine disaster in West Virginia in 1927. So famous last words are part of the inspiration for a theatrical event which opens tonight at the National Gallery of Victoria. Georgia Moody knows all about it. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Nice to have you here. What is this production?
Well, it's called The Last Supper, and it's by the UK contemporary theatre outfit Restless Sleepers. They've been invited to Australia by the Malthouse Theatre in Melbourne, and they're performing this work, which is kind of part meal, part performance, under the much-loved, beautiful, colourful mosaic ceiling of the Great Hall at the National Gallery of Victoria.
Great big glass ceiling there. So what's it all about?
Well, they've taken the famous last words of queens and politicians and celebrities and inventors and written them on rice paper, which the performers then eat. And it's not just the performers who get to eat. If you're part of the audience, you get, and you pull the right number from a hat, you could be given the last meal, which was requested by a death row inmate in Texas. But a warning, some of the meals are better than others. One of the meals is a chocolate birthday cake, which sounds pretty good. But another plate consists weirdly of one apple, one orange, one banana, one coconut and three peaches.
Sounds healthy.
It does, doesn't it? So today we're joined by the director of The Last Supper, who's also one of the three performers. His name is Moll Wetherill, and he explains what sparked the idea for this project.
Well, it was a sequence of quite happy accidents, really. We were asked by a festival in Ghent in Belgium if we'd like to make a Last Supper. And I said, yes, okay. And I just had this image in my head of eating last words. It was from a Peter Greenaway film called The Cook, the Thief, the Wife and His Lover. The lover gets force-fed a book and dies. And I thought that image was quite useful, and Tim said, yeah, we could eat rice paper. And then out of the blue, some guy came over to our discussion and said, I've got this ream of paper and they're all last meal requests from prisoners on death row, Texas. Would it be useful? And I said, yes. And that pretty much is the show. And this was 10, 12 years ago that this happened. So, and of course, we did some research and I read a lot of books. A lot of the last 10 pages of a lot of books just to determine the last moments of people throughout history. And that's how the project evolved. So it wasn't like some great inspirational artist in an ivory tower thinking of some brilliant series of connections. It was just a series of happy accidents that created the show.
Who are some of the people whose last words you're bringing to life in this Last Supper?
A whole series of people throughout history. There was a number of people who were either assassinated or executed, like Trotsky, for instance, or trying to think of someone else who was executed, or Jesus, of course. And then famous people who I have a particular respect for, like Kafka and Einstein.
And are these all verified last words? Is there some imagined last words?
There are a combination of the two. What we found through the research, and I did some proper research, and we found that a lot of the last words from people throughout history were rewritten in the Victorian era to suit, I think, some kind of parlour game of the last words of Marie Antoinette were, "I beg your pardon, I did not do that on purpose." And the joke there, not that we get it, because it's 150 years old as a joke, was, "I beg your pardon." So we kept that one, even though we don't really know what Marie Antoinette's last words were. I think a lot of them were invented. There's a huge text from Newton, and it might have just been, but there's a huge thing about looking at the sea and blah, 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 blah. You know, it's just a funny kind of thing that people want the last words of famous people to be meaningful. Mm. And I think some of them are. But, you know, we're going to try and slip in Ned Kelly's last words because he's from, well, he was executed just up the road.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Well, how exactly does the Last Supper work? People come and they sit down at one of three tables.
Yeah, it's like a U-shaped table. And there are 13 on each of the three big tables. So it's like an audience becomes a Last Supper as the Leonardo da Vinci painting. As they come in, they're given a ticket, like a bingo-sized ticket, and that determines where they sit. So what's nice is people don't actually, or they rarely sit next to their friend or boyfriend, wife, husband. And that breaks down a bit of a barrier. People are generally quite open and friendly and chat to each other, which is great, because that generally doesn't happen in a theatre. And the ticket determines if you get a meal or not, one of the last meal requests from prisoners on death row. So we serve 13.
So you might turn up and not be fed?
Yeah. so, it's a bit
so
of a lottery.
People turn up hungry, or what do you think?
Well, yeah, people know that there's the possibility of not getting a meal. I mean, you might get liver and onions, which is someone's last meal request, and it's rare that people have eaten that.
That's good. So there's no one has to eat the food.
Oh, no, we're not going to force feed you the food. But what we do find is that everyone eats the chocolate birthday cake.
Oh, who wouldn't?
Mm. But at the end of the show, we found that people stay around, and we encourage people to stay around and chat. And the cake will find its way around the room, and people share the food that's left over. And often people take the coconut home with them because it's like they're at the fair.
It's a good memento.
Yeah. And I mean, everyone gets a glass of wine, red wine or water. But yeah, it's quite a social experience. It's like sitting down for a meal.
So it's kind of part meal, part performance.
Yes.
And you're going to perform part of the Last Supper for us now.
Yes.
What are we going to hear?
I wrote something. I invented something. And it's the last words of Albert Einstein. And it goes like this. Lying on his deathbed, Albert Einstein, a flashback to his early youth, making little sense in German, refusing to take morphine for the pain so he can see straight, think of one last thought, experiment. Making one last observation, remembering his first ever words and what his last words should be, muttering to himself as he tries to work out another question, playing dice with God, putting his hand in an oven for a minute, but it feels like an hour. Travelling at 600 million miles per second with a girl on a train, but it only feels like a minute. Eating cold soup. Travelling out into space, back down again here on Earth. His last words, "I have done my job."
Fantastic. Moll, you're talking about people's last words, people's last meals.
Yes.
Is this a production about death? Do you want people to be thinking about death?
I think we're always thinking about death. I mean, what we found with this show, it's a much more adult audience. A lot of grey hair in the audience, so maybe there's a signifier there. I mean, I did write the show, it was around the time that my dad was dying, so I was quite conscious of that. So maybe that seeped into the piece. I don't really want to focus on anything. You know, it's not like it's a political project that wants to make an issue about the death penalty. It's just, it's inherent in the work, as is death and life. And when we were last in Australia, Lane was pregnant, and that was like doubly interesting because we're talking about death and a new life is about to appear. You know?
Is she one of the performers?
Lane is, yeah, yeah. I think about death whilst I'm doing it, and as I'm sure other people do, and lots of people in the audience have said how it's affected them and made them think about their own family and people they've missed and maybe what their last words might be. And some people that do get the meals are quite shocked by that. And there's an implication that that's their last meal or it's delivered in front of them. And it's quite a shocking experience to have that object in front of them. For my work, I really want people to think about lots of other things. It's not like there's a singular idea. And I talk about this a lot, that I quite like gaps in work, like books. You know, it's not the full image that you ever get. There's plenty of gaps for a reader or an audience to fill and bring their own world into that. And that goes across for all the work that we make. It leaves enough gaps for imagination to take place.
Has it made you think about what you might like your last meal to be?
Yeah, I do get that question quite a lot. And I always say it would be steak and kidney pie, chips and gravy, which is a comfort food from the chip shop, which we used to go to every Saturday. It was a bit of a tradition.
And what about your last words?
Oh. That's such a difficult one, because I do recall the last words of my mum, actually, in the show. And, you know, she was pumped full of morphine and not making much sense. I imagine that that's maybe where I'd be in this. It could be just like James Dean, who said, that guy's got to stop. Or, you know, JFK said, that's obvious. It could be something as quick as that, or something much more long-winded and abstract, and maybe a joke. I'd like to go out with a joke, I think. I'm thinking of Oscar Wilde, who apparently said, either that wallpaper goes or I do. but again, there's another one. I'm dying beyond my means. So there's two reported last words from Oscar Wilde.
Fantastic. Yeah. They're both pretty good.
Yeah.
And Mal Weatherall is the director of and one of the three performers in The Last Supper, and he was speaking there to Georgia Moody. So the show's being performed at the National Gallery of Victoria in Melbourne at the invitation of the Malthouse Theatre. It opened this very night and it runs through until the 12th of July. Well, that concludes the proceedings for this evening. We made this show at 10 o'clock this morning, as we do every weekday morning, and we repeat it for you between the hours of 2 and 3 here in the Wee Smalls, because we know you're there. We know you want something lovely to listen to, so that's why we do it. Our next show is going to be a big one. We're going to look at the new movie version of Far From the Madding Crowd, which I saw on Monday. It's a lovely film. If you pop along, I'm sure you'll enjoy it. So that's in our book to screen segment. We talk about the book that inspired the film, and then we talk about the film. And we've also got a play which is called Shit, which is a title. It stops you in your tracks, isn't it? It wakes you up in the middle of the night. It's by the award-winning Aussie playwright Patricia Cornelius, so the chances are that it's pretty good despite its name. Well, that concludes proceedings for this evening. We're coming up to the news, and then there'll be more great listening here on RN. I'm Michael Cathcart. A very good night to you.